The recently released movie, The Death of Stalin, is both shriekingly funny and utterly terrifying. I can attest to its accuracy because I've both read widely on the subject and also interviewed at length the people with a direct knowledge of the event itself and its bloodstained aftermath. But it's one thing to be privy to eyewitness accounts of events surrounding the death of a man who, along with Adolf Hitler and Mao Zedong, ranks as one of the most evil tyrants of recent history. But it's quite another to see the same events reenacted in glorious technicolor and with grisly exactitude on the silver screen. To be deeply aware of the murderous nature of the regime that for 70 years devised the policies and directed the affairs of one of the world's two superpowers is one thing. But it's quite another to sit riveted to a graphic portrayal of the ruthless conduct of the depraved, indecisive, and incompetent individuals who headed it for so long. It is chilling to think that for the best part of four decades, this evil but inept ship of fools had its paranoic finger on the trigger of sufficient nuclear power to destroy the world several times over. My fascination with the men who mastered the Soviet Empire dates back to the mid-1960s and early 70s, when I made my living as a criminologist, one of the folks employed by newspapers and broadcasting outfits to figure out what sort of mischief the Soviets and their allies were up to. Criminology might seem a romantic way to earn a living. The word conjures up visions of clandestine missions, the rattle of machine guns at remote border crossings, beautiful blondes, and exotic restaurants in exotic cities. Not so, lamentably. Criminology was far from romantic. To be sure, there are interesting opportunities for travel, but generally, criminologists devoted most of their working lives to talking to deceitful diplomats and tedious technocrats, and poring over the Soviet media, trying to sift facts from half-truths, propaganda, and outright lies. If we were painfully ignorant of the inept, indecisive, and cowardly character of the politicians who led the country, it was because they operated wrapped in a paranoid cocoon of secrecy. Maps of the country, including Moscow's official street guide, were deliberately falsified. Indeed, Moscow didn't even have a published telephone directory. As a consequence, it took years, for instance, for Western intelligence agencies to pinpoint the precise location in Kazakhstan from which the Soviets launched their space shots. So much of what passed for news in the Soviet media was propaganda and disinformation that the only information deemed reasonably reliable was culled from obscure, deadly dull academic and technical journals, particularly the statistical sections. Changes in pecking order in the upper echelons of the Soviet hierarchy were divined with such shaky forecasting tools as the places assigned to members of the Politburo on top of Lenin's tomb in Moscow's Red Square for the viewing of the May Day military parade. Given the ephemeral nature of the material available to analysts, criminologists were by no means always right. We were way off track about Soviet technology. The consensus was that it was quite advanced, almost equal to our own, occasionally even better. In fact, it was primitive, almost beyond belief. But we had a good excuse for being so far off the truth. Soviets and their allies were extraordinarily secretive, and considering the vast effort they put into misleading and deceiving us, it's remarkable how often we were right. Today, Russia has changed, not so much as we would have liked, perhaps, but even so, it's a rather more open society than it was in the days of Brezhnev and co. This means criminologists are no longer in quite such demand. In fact, ambitious political analysts have turned to more fruitful fields of endeavor. North Korea, Iran, the Arab countries of the Middle East, and of course, the goings on in Washington and other world capitals, allied and unfriendly. The success rate of today's intelligence gatherers probably reflects the flaws inherent in the methodology often employed. This includes the gross overestimation, and very occasionally, the gross underestimation of the policymakers whose work is being assessed and the economic resources at their disposal. Back in my day, many criminologists, for example, forecast that the Soviet Union would utterly outstrip America economically and ultimately become the world's sole superpower. It was a bizarre notion, utterly unwarranted by the USSR's anemic economic performance. But as there were few trustworthy statistics available, the theory was very hard to gainsay. Dubious theories evolved about the refined intellectual tastes of the ruthless, banal, utterly unimaginative Yuri Andropov, head of the KGB, and for a short time General Secretary of the Soviet Communist Party. It was, for instance, confidently asserted that he collected modern art and that he spent his evenings sipping scotch, reading Scott Fitzgerald, and listening to American jazz greats. Now, it's true that Stalin adored Western movies and forced his Politburo to watch them with him, but it's a bit of a stretch to imagine that fans of Tom Mix and John Wayne would morph into aficionados of Scott Fitzgerald and Thelonious Monk. Actually, the Kremlin in-crowd tended to have rather more earthy tastes. Brezhnev swilled vodka in prodigious quantities and collected fast Western sports cars, including Ferraris and Mercedes-Benz, while his daughter's inamorata was an acrobat from Moscow State Circus. Go figure. Back in the old days, I often used to wonder what Brezhnev and co. Felt about folks like me reading their strategic and economic tea leaves. I now realize just how bemused, befuddled, and bewildered they must have been. How much simpler life would have been for all of us if they'd given us the straight skinny about what was going on in their minds. But then, of course, they would have been revealed for all to see as an evil, pitiless, incompetent bunch of rogues. And interacting with a culture as paranoid as that of the Soviets, the truth would probably be more dangerous than the fiction. The lesson from all is that perhaps it's better, initially at least, not to ascribe to mendacity what can satisfactorily be explained by stupidity. Similarly, consumers of political intelligence would be wise to abide by the maxim caveat emptor, buyer beware.